Summit?
Yeah. Some are invisible today. Yeah. I'd like to call the November 21st meeting of Ways and Means to order. We do not have a quorum, so this will just be discussion purposes today for the budget amendment. Are we waiting for Legislator Corcoran or? Okay, so then I get Legislator Nolan and Stewart.
So, I don't think we want to do that at all. Got it. Perfect. This was a recommendation that for a discussion that came up at our public works, at our public health meeting, and we were basically informed that there is currently employees in the Department of Health that are taking on the task of doing filing and other things that can be done by a filing clerk at much lower cost and bringing up that person for some additional work that is needed to be accomplished. So this is a very simple amendment that just says we think that this position would be cost effective. It's a relatively small amount, and so we're requesting the support to put it into the budget.
Yes, and I also wanted to add that it's too bad that our associate, our colleague, Tom Cochran, could not be here today. He felt very strongly about this situation. When Dr. Smith was explaining the situation in our committee meeting, you know, she was saying how, as Legislator Nolan said, that, you know, these people are doing tasks that, you know, could be better and more efficiently done by someone lower down on the food chain, so to speak. And this is the portion of the health department that deals with septic systems, that deals with inspections at restaurants, that deals with
permits.
And so because of all the construction and renovation that's going on right now, they're just completely overwhelmed, and adding this position at $37,000 a year with benefits, it comes to what, 55? Yeah, that this would greatly free up their manpower and allow them to function more efficiently and serve our citizens better. So we hope that you will consider voting for this.
Cool.
Sure. I got to give you guys something to do.
Well, thank you for entertaining us.
Does the Department of Health, did they request this, or did you guys come up with it on your own?
Go ahead. Dr. Smith made the presentation, and I looked at Tom, and Tom looked at me. He's like, we need to get some funding, is basically how we did. And then Kathy. Yeah, and I'm right with you, so.
It was basically a discussion of whether there were anything from the department that didn't get into the budget that seemed like maybe could be looked at again. So on this second look, when you have people who, the people in the office can do the filing, can do the records management, and they are doing it, but then they're not doing some of the tasks for which they have credentials and only they can do. So this seemed like this situation where we wanted the administration to look at it again, and the way to do that was to put in an amendment and have this discussion. But if you can hire another person into the office that is dedicated to doing this, and this is enough to take up a full-time position, then we should go ahead and do that, because otherwise you'll continue to have people splitting their attention between what they were actually hired to do and this part of keeping the office going.
And you're budgeting for 1 year? $37,000, 20-year salary?
This is 1 year salary.
Yeah.
And presumably this position will become one that would continue on, because the workload is only getting heavier.
Yes.
Not going down.
And like I said, Legislator Cochran felt very strongly about this, and since he deals with this department on a daily basis in his professional life, he was well aware of the need for this and as a strong advocate for it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Oh, I'm leaving. Okay.
Thank you for raising the issue. And we'd like to have a little more conversation, more robust conversation internally, because I think there might be an opportunity to think about the way in which we're handling records and how to better transition to digital records to then streamline it going forward, understanding that there are legacy records as well. So I think more than just keeping up with the current kind of paper filing demands, we might use this as an opportunity to look forward also. And maybe it's a combination of things, not just necessarily having a body to do the physical filing, but something else. So
it might be worth having a conversation about then just as a one-year, you know, an idea to hire a consultant and additional temporary help. If there's going to be a change in the way those records are handled and the workload.
Looking at things like online permit filing, currently right now both our highway department and the health department are
paper only,
non-fillable PDFs that are available online. So looking at other ways also to kind of look at the filing systems. And
so
the technology behind it.
Let's continue to talk, because it seems like there's something needed to keep us from slipping backward while you're waiting for that new system to come in.
Yes.
Yeah, and I was going to say similar to that, is that, you know, digitization of records and going with, at some point, I think, a replacement of Munis will also have to be looked at. I know we've talked about that in the past. But even just going to a full-time position concerns me, where we don't know if there's really a full-time need, because you've got something multiple people doing this function. Does that really collectively equal a full-time position? I don't know the answer. I'm just sort of posing the question. But also, and I've brought this up for years, we don't have a resource management person in the county that could help to move excess time around between departments, and that's really, we've got a large pool of, we've got a large workforce here that if we were able to shuffle things around when seasons get busier, like every time we brought about the Board of Elections, they've got a couple of windows where they're the busiest they're going to be, and there's times in other departments that it's slower, not to pick on budget, but you mentioned in my previous meeting where certain times of the year your department's going to be busier than others. There's excess that we could, if we could work together, that I think we could accomplish a lot of these tasks, and going to digital is obviously the way of the future. So.
I'm going to stay up here
because you have a whole list. All right. Thank you all so much.
All right, Legislator Nolan, number 44.
Yes. So, this is another amendment that addresses the fact that there is, within the department, within the Bureau, it says that more could be done if there were additional hands. And so this is an amendment to bring in additional staffing to work with trying to do grant writing and bringing in additional funding and outreach. So this is a little bit more expensive position because it would be dealing with the public, and so the sense that I had was that we have youth in the county that are not receiving all that they could receive. Many of them don't come through our door. And so I'm reminded of the discussion we had yesterday in regard to dealing with the school districts. And I think there is something that's needed to move us off the place where we are, where the school district has its services and we have our programs and how well they're interfacing. I don't think they're interfacing as well as they could. So this amendment was designed to bring in a person who could try to address some of that kind of sense that the system has a lot of resources in it, but they're not always being effectively used and reaching the people who need them.
The same way.
I heard grant writing, disposition.
Yeah, it's not designed as a grant writing position, because you could hire a grant writer, but to basically find those funding sources that we're currently not finding that can be directed towards our youth.
Because yesterday we just talked about, I guess we just went up to 75 or 77,000 in salary for the two grant writing positions that I was assured is going to be connecting with each and every department and office in order to grant write 24/7 for everyone. So it seems counter to that, is my only point.
Yeah, I wasn't here for that, but I did hear about it, and I think that might actually address a large part of what I was trying to accomplish here. So I would be happy to have conversations and withdraw this proposal if the grant writing part of it can specifically be made available to the Youth Bureau.
Well, you know, we've already approved two positions, two grant writers. We increased the salary last year in April or May, something like that.
It would have been May, yeah.
Yeah, so because we weren't able to recruit anybody. So to look for grants to the county, but also to help with the grant writing, polish up grant applications from the townships as well.
The other portion of this that I didn't mention is that the Youth Bureau currently doesn't have a person that does their budgeting and is their kind of numbers person. And so they share other people, as we were saying, can be helpful. But I think they were feeling like they didn't, by not having anybody assigned to them, that they often fell short in terms of taking advantage of these things. So a grant writing person wouldn't be a financial analyst for sure, but might be a better bridge with those kind of financial concerns, because the Youth Bureau has to do all that, but doesn't have anybody in the Bureau that has that as their specific competence or training. So if we can, again, maybe have the conversations of how to make sure that periodically, at least, somebody is checking in and making sure that all of those kind of concerns get addressed, that might be a less expensive way than another position. So I'm open to that, but wanted to bring the conversation forward.
I don't think I follow. What do you mean by a financial position? What work would they have to do, or do they do in the youth?
Well,
that's not done by county finance.
Well, just in terms of even things like developing this coming year's budget and how to, not just how to submit something, because you can always submit what was submitted the last year, but how to find additional monies and additional resources and build it in. And it's probably, that's the reason I characterized it as a grant writer, although it's not necessarily even writing a grant. It may actually be that there's funding that just requires, you know, some kind of simpler outreach than a grant. But somebody who is skilled at working with developing the resources and building a program instead of just managing a program. So, again, I think that my intent was to open up the conversation and not have that position and request just go away because we have too many other requests on our plate. I think there are ways to make the Youth Bureau function better, and that's what we were hearing, that it was a desire to do more, but a feeling that the resources weren't there to accomplish that. So I will go back to the Youth Bureau and the administration and discuss if there's another way to do this, and I think the point about the grant writers is very helpful, because that will bring in some of that kind of focus that I, what I was hearing is not, it just hasn't come together.
Okay. Number 45.
So, this is for the Department of Mental Health, and basically related to the opening of the Stabilization Center and the building at 368 Broadway. And what we were hearing in the description of how that would all work was that there would be staffing that would all have some kind of responsibility.
You're on 46. 45 has changed the DSS personnel.
So sorry. Thank you. This is a resolution to basically make changes that the administration and the staff of DSS have discussed and believe are better than what they put in their original budget. And it's basically a reallocation of the positions and the addition, I think, of one position so that the original intent of having all of the needs of the offices met would be met. And I thought Joanna was maybe going to be here to talk about this.
She had to step away for another urgent matter.
Yeah. So she did describe them in detail to me, but I don't have those details with me to give you. So we could either come back.
Yeah, let's come back to them.
Yeah, when she's here and able to describe the details of that.
Okay.
And
now actually you're 46.
Yeah, 46, so I already started talking about. So this is over at the Stabilization Center. And my concern was, on hearing the description, was that it was going to be everybody's responsibility to meet people and get them routed to where they needed to go, but not a single person all the time. And so it seemed like, and we heard the descriptions, that it was always like one person short. Well, this person's going to be doing their job and doing this, and this other person is going to be doing their job and doing this. And that's just a big building. And having it be a place where people are coming for really whatever is their crisis, it needs to function as a one-stop shop. And so it seemed to me that the staffing was inadequate to accomplish that. So this is basically setting things up so that one person would have that responsibility. And I don't know why it is, how we were able to get that to not have an increase in the finance in the budget for it. I think it's just changing around the assignments of the people so that when you get somebody at a lower pay grade who is assigned to do this, then you don't need an additional person. Is that what you did?
No.
How'd you do it?
This
looks like magic now that I'm looking at it again.
The county executive recommended budget has a $50,000 contractual expense for temp agency funding. So this is offsetting the temp agency funding and funding the person instead.
I'd forgotten that.
Legislator Petit.
Thank you. I thought the Stabilization Center was going to be managed by an outside vendor who would be doing review of needs of incoming people. So I'm confused about putting in a permanent staff from Department of Health.
I did not understand that that was going to be the approach.
I think just, and obviously Deputy Exec Contreras can speak more detailed on this, but my understanding is the Crisis Stabilization Center is going to co-locate not only our Department of Mental Health, but a number of other voluntary agencies. And so having this receptionist there provides a model where, individual is able to walk in and they're able to get directed directly to services rather than kind of bouncing around. And I think that's the intent of this.
But wouldn't that be through, again, the vendor who would be better able to put qualified people in so that they could make those decisions, especially given, you know, it can be volatile situations or, you know, they may even be brought in by law enforcement if they choose to go there instead. I'm surprised that we're looking to hire another person to do this because we have two qualified vendors there now, some Peoples and Samadhi. And this is basically all they do.
But yeah. This was assigned to this temp person, and that might be how this vendor was attempting to do it. But I don't think that's a good system. You know, this is actually the most important point in the building. And all of those people, the vendor and the contract agencies, all of them will do their job 1,000 times better if the person who comes in the door immediately goes to the right next door. Because if they come in through the door and somebody is a temporary person or a consultant who doesn't know all of these programs very well, then the person can end up going to the second floor, back down to the first floor, back to the third floor. And that could work, but it's just not nearly as good. And you're talking about the difference between, I've forgotten this, doing it with a temporary person or doing it with a person who gets to know all those programs and is, you know, kind of stabilizing. So in a stabilization center, you should have somebody there who really knows everything. And this is my experience in hospital settings. You know, the person in the emergency room the clerk can sometimes be really determinative of the quality of care that you get. So, yes, it's good we have these good programs, but I really, the county is set up to try to have a single point of access when you have a person that we encounter in the street or in one of our clinics. And those people are specifically trained into how to make single point of access work. So I just didn't feel like it was a good idea to have this be somebody's job that rotated, or it was this person on one day, the consultant tells you that it should be mental health doing it. I think we know better about this than the vendor who's going to come in and operate there. So, that it's budget neutral means we should just discuss and see what we think is best. You know, if there's a reason that we think this vendor would be able to do this better than us, but I don't. I think that this is the having the person there and get to know. Right now there's not all that many people who know all of the different places you can go. And I guess it's not a good analogy, but this is like a call center. And if you have the same people staffing the call center all of the time, you're going to get a better result than if you're changing that out all the time, because they just won't know what's available behind all those other doors.
Where did this request come from?
This request came following the presentations of the Department of Mental Health and DSS at our public health meeting. And I reached back out to Commissioner McDonald at following it with my concern about how that system had been described and how it was going to work, and with my thought that it might be better to have a permanent person. And she supported that idea, so I brought forward the amendment.
Okay, so my understanding of the way we were trying to do this, way back when Legislator Walter was still here, was we were going to see how this grows, because we didn't know. We've never done a stabilization center before, and to me, normally I don't like contracting something that we can do ourselves. In this case, I think it makes more sense to contract, because we may not need that person after we're up and running. We may find out that we need another type of physician to have it where we're not keeping on a legacy cost. And once we hire somebody, we say it all the time, you're here, you're a permanent employee, because we don't get rid of people. So with the exception of one department that I can think of, we closed down since I've been here. For the most part, we start something and we just keep rolling with it. This gives us the opportunity to put a temporary person in there while we get up and running, And then if we decide that that's what we need, an admin typist position, maybe it's not an admin typist position. Maybe it's on the previous one, or the DSS one, like a clerical.
Records.
There was one that's the less, there was a lower salary amount person. Maybe that's the position to have, but we don't know yet because we're just sort of finding our way.
Well, I remember those discussions, and I agree with that approach in general. You know, it's something new that you're trying to keep it fluid so that you discover what you need, and I supported that. When I heard this, where we don't have anyone, like no one person that's stable through that can even give report back on all those different encounters, then I thought, no, that's, you know, it's too much fluidity for me. So this is an attempt to just have one anchor point, and I don't think you could at all make it down to a records clerk. This is somebody who's greeting the public, so it could be something, some potentially require a higher training, but I don't think so. I think most of our service organizations have a person or persons who greet the public, and that's a skill set, and that's the skill set we need. And I just have been not impressed with temp agencies for that kind of person. I mean, yes, you can get them in to do administrative clerk and filing, but I think that we want to hire a good person and keep a good person. And the idea that we wouldn't need that type of person at this setting, nobody has said that. They've all said this person could do it, or that person could do it, or it could be this temp agency. So there's been a lot of ideas about how to do it. My thinking is, get one person who really is going to be a stabilizing presence in that system. And I think otherwise you're going to have that first year or 18 months of this is going to be chaotic. And I don't see how a temp person coming in is going to provide that. So.
I mean, there's temp companies that you can have somebody temporary for 6 months, for a year. There's one group of it around, somewhere around here actually, that does it.
And sometimes you get lucky, and then you want to even hire that person. But you get unlucky, and this whole multi-million-dollar thing is now relying on a temp agency hire. That's what made me say, this doesn't seem like best planning here.
Well,
so,
it's actually better protection, potentially, because if you don't like the person, you replace them with. When we hire somebody, we don't know what type of employee that person's going to be when we hire them. We actually have an easier time if it's a temp agency, we don't like the person, say the temp agency, it's not working out, sorry.
That's true. That is true. But the difference is we are hiring the permanent person, and a temp agency who is trying to ken what our needs are is hiring the other person. So I think you're right that it's riskier that you might get locked in to somebody, although you can usually transfer somebody to a different position, even if if they're bad enough, then we can fire somebody. But what I really would like is to have our people deciding who gets this job instead of the temp agency.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Legislator Petit, you're up. Sure, that's the problem.
That's the problem. I can't read it. We did that on purpose. So I have an amendment number 47, and this is to separate out the staff from roads and bridges. Public Works has multiple offices, nearing almost a dozen. Each one of those has the staffing separated out, with the exception of roads and bridges. Now, it still comes out of the same pot of gold, so to speak, but this would make it clearer if roads was to pull from the bridges work crew, that there would be a transfer, so you could basically follow which employee was working at what site. And that would definitely help with future needs
four bridges. They're losing several folks due to retirement. They've had a few pass away. And also through the attrition that was offered several years ago during COVID, they lost several qualified employees with the early retirement package. So this is just to clean up the way the budget is broken down.
Is there any impact operationally?
I was always under the impression that bridges and roads, the employees were interchangeable. They're not?
They are, but as we put more positions in, a lot of them are pulled. They have a welder that's pulled from bridges, and that's a critical position for them because they also do work on vehicles when they're damaged, and he does a lot of flagging.
Would this create a need for more management?
No. No, because it's currently being done. It's just we're trying to follow. It's kind of a bouncing ball.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
So highway, for the part of highway, and then you have buildings and grounds. So you want them, you want there to basically be buildings and grounds, bridge, and highway. I don't have any issue with that. I don't think I've heard the same stories. They're not finishing up projects that they could be finishing up because they literally have men and women that are needed. You know, they were paving roads and they got bridge workers flagging. There's all these different complaints I have about working out of title. Some people get paid out of title. Some people don't. So who you know? It's a real mess. To be honest with you, public works is an absolute mess. There's about 70 of the guys right now down at, and men and women down at the CSEA office building complaining and having meetings with the people that are actually causing the problems. But anyways, so I don't have a problem with this. I'm just curious how it goes. And I think your point is it just makes it a little more transparent as they do. And I've heard all kinds of issues about how much more from all these different low-level supervisors and stuff that how much more efficient they could be if there was better coordination over public works. We have a real issue with the head of public works. He hasn't, from what I understand, he hasn't been to a different job site. And they don't even know what he looks like. So I don't have a problem with this, but how does it work? Because there's the contract aspect of it that I've been dealing with where there's different schedules. You want to pull them out of that schedule or you just want it separated? So when you get online, you'd see, right now if you get online, you see highway and buildings and grounds. But other than that, besides maybe on their shirts, instead of it saying public works or highway, it would say, but other than that, what does it really, how does this, what separate, what is different?
And that's a great question. You know, it never prohibits, because public works is a very broad, you know, you have your buildings and grounds, and you have highways and roads, and you have your bridges and rails, and they work at different buildings, and they're assigned to, they have a skill set for a particular job. But, you know, basically it's one budget line, it's all your personnel. What this will do is you'll be able to see who you have in your highway, and this is actual job titles. And I can't really speak to union. I mean, my basic knowledge of it is if you're in a job title, if you're a welder and they want you to flag, they can't decrease your salary. And there is a lot of out of title. We have someone now who's an MEO who works out of title constantly. We're talking thousands of dollars. So it makes it easier if you define where these workers are and where these workers are, because MEOs are actually in both roads and bridges, but the personnel would be assigned to those two different departments. And it was, I'm trying to read this really small print, guys. The MEO bridge workers are all the ones up on top. And then, you know, if you go down further below, you'll see there's CEOs and MEOs as well. So it was just a simple matter of pulling the two apart based on the job titles that were assigned to the bridges, you know, department, and to the roads. So if there is any you know, borrowing of personnel. And, you know, if something happens, it's all hands on deck. You're going to get them all out plowing roads if we're getting 2 feet of snow. And
so what,
you know, if there's
changes in our financial system, like what we have them listed as in our financial
system? What actually changes, and I'll defer to our financial analyst, is that when they borrow somebody to go help if they're short-staffed for roads and they need flaggers or they need heavy equipment operators, MEOs, then there's just a transfer. So you'll be able to follow where the need was and who they're pulling. So if they're constantly pulling from one crew to help work somewhere else, well, perhaps in the future we need to budget so you have more people on roads or you have more people on bridges.
I'm still,
and I'm with you because I have all the same it? I have all the same issues with I'm talking to the same people you are a lot. I have the same issues that you have. I still not following. If this was done tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
what is this? So Bob calls Rich and
tool.
Says, "What? I mean, how does anything actually change from this?"
It sounds like the accounting.
It's an accounting.
It's strictly an accounting function here. That's the way I'm understanding this. This would just be so instead of looking at the bridges budget, and you see X dollars now. And because they're actually not utilizing all those hours because they're being floated to highway, you would realize that they should be debiting their budget to move it over to the highway budget to more accurately reflect what's actually being expended in each department. So the personnel, functionally, I don't know how this works in the finance department. This seems like a lot of moving money around throughout the year, but I believe that's the concept here.
Can we see that between buildings and grounds and highway now?
Not buildings and grounds, highway and bridges. Buildings and grounds is a separate, that's a separate department, so to speak.
But they swap is what I'm saying, so wouldn't we see the accounting that you're talking about when they pull?
I don't know if buildings and grounds ever pulls from roads or that's a real specialized. You need to have your heavy equipment. You know, a lot of them have their CDLs, their welders. That's a whole different skill set than buildings and grounds, which is more maintenance and supplies.
I'm pretty sure they help each other out at times.
They may.
But if we don't ever see that, then why would we see
this? And you're not
going
to see it. Well,
how would we know where it is?
I keep looking over it. But maybe
Nichols out.
Yeah.
Had some your mic.
Thank you. So the county executive very much supports fortifying the bridge crew so that they can run more effective crews in the field, and there is included in the budget several positions for the bridge crew, including a welder to support the bridge crew in and of itself. So we're very interested in moving forward with making more functional crew and also work units so that they can be better devoted to doing bridge work, which they do so well, and you know, getting these projects done. That said, it's my understanding by creating another division, they would still, if bridge were its own division, it would still be supervised by the field operation.
Yes, yes.
Field supervisor, so that's currently held by Lyle Baker, would
right.
still be supervising both the highway side of the shop and the bridge side of
right.
the shop.
Right, there's no changes there.
So, you know, there are several titles that are specific to the bridge shop. There are two titles that are unique to the bridge shop. There are several titles that are used in the bridge shop that are not unique to the bridge shop. So there's a little bit of, you would have to parse it just for the ones in that division. So I don't totally, we can account for, you know, who's working on the bridge crew. That's something that we could always do as far as looking at their report to locations or some other way in the budget without creating a division. So I'm just going to listen a little bit more about what you're trying to do with this
right.
to better understand. Because
And I said the division wasn't supposed to totally separate or take away that pool of skilled workers. But it was so that we could see the accountability to see who was getting pulled where. As I said, there's a welder who's been traditionally working as a flagger, and welding is a skill set and a pay grade that is way above flagging. And there's especially again, this is another department that through attrition had lost many of their skilled people. They have a really great crew. They've worked with getting each other CDLs, so they're willing to go out and get the extra training. But that being said, they also feel like, you know, there's a lot of pulling from their pool of workers. It's purely accounting.
Yeah, just to speak directly to the welder, that is one of the positions that's in the executive's budget, is a welder that is specific to the bridge crew.
Okay, so that's the second position.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was a position pulled. I mean, now we're kind of going into the next, you know, the next amendment, but there was a lead bridge person that was turned into a lead road person. So they actually lost one person there.
Before you skip on to that one, I just want to understand this. If your intent is for it to not impact anything operationally, then I don't even know why we have to do this, why we can't just do this as through the budget department and through finance throughout the year, move the expenditures to accurately reflect where they're actually being placed.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're being pulled out of bridges for you don't want to do this every pay period. Well, I guess you could, because it's a job code, I would assume. I don't know what
our payroll system is. If there's a division, there would be a job code, so it would be easier to follow instead of asking a department to specifically focus on that and look at the timesheets and say, well, where did they work? Because that wouldn't be out of budget. Isn't that the personnel director? No. There's a separate payroll.
But it'll show up in the accounting ledger here, and you'll see it under the GL numbers. You'll be able to see that you'll see it under the payroll line. You'll see that there's an increase in the...
No.
Why wouldn't you see...
They're combined right now.
If this amendment is adopted, you would see it.
That's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing. No.
Okay.
I'm agreeing. I'm just making sure that this does not impact anything operationally where they're sharing employees, they're moving people around. I'm saying that this can be accomplished, but I'm also trying to verify and guarantee that operationally we don't stop ourselves from borrowing a welder when we need
it.
That's why I just want to be clear that that's what we're trying to do. It's just it's to more accurately account for this,
mm-hmm.
but not impact the operational.
Because
the bridge authority, I know somebody just retired from the New York State Bridge Authority. During the wintertime, there's no work to do on the bridges. He was out plowing with the state highway department.
And they do that.
Okay, so I just want to make sure we weren't trying to, changing that.
Deputy LaValle said there's no changes as far as the upper management goes, and they delegate the work and the crews and even the job sites. So, I mean, they've put, even though it was roads, they've put bridges on slope stabilization. So there's no changes there to where the work
okay.
is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's operational. Good. Okay.
So I appreciate this discussion because I didn't understand what benefit this would bring, and the accounting benefit seems clear. I guess I'm just would wonder, you know, how the department feels about this, and I wonder if it has any potential impact that we might not be seeing on funding. If there are funding sources that fund all the works of that department, and it requires some of this sharing, and this accounting would make it appear that we don't have the right number of people for certain types of contracts or whatever I'm not sure, you know, when it's our own internal funding, then it wouldn't have any impact. But for roads and bridges, we sometimes do have other sources of funding. And I guess it needs to be accurate, but if what they need in a certain contract with the DEP, for example, on some of the bridges, is a certain number of staff, and by doing this we end up looking like we have half that number of staff, I'd like a little bit of exploration for unintended consequences and whether the department feels like this would be a burden in any way. If it's purely accounting, I guess it's following on
Chair Kovaris's point here, if it's purely accounting, then it seems unproblematic. But it just feels like, well, why is it this way instead of the other way if, you know, it's just a purely accounting thing? And sometimes that's just nobody looked at it and said, let's get clearer. But sometimes it's because there was, it made it easier to do certain things. And I it's working like it is as far as I can see. The harm that's being done under our current system does not seem clear to me. The potential for a marginal benefit in accounting clarity, I accept, but I want to be sure there's no real risk to it. And so I guess we can go to the department and maybe look at the funding sources of whether there's any implications there.
And again, pulling from another workforce, the bridge crew only did one bridge this year because they were being pulled for slope stabilization. I think one was up in the Shandaken area, which was through, I keep wanting to say USDA, but USGUS. So their crew was done for that. But so it was, what is it?
USGS.
That's the one. Okay.
United States Geological.
Right, right. So again, there's no issue pulling skilled workers to do something that's not necessarily a bridge or a rail, because they have a very specific a work set, which is bridges and rails. But it did impact the amount of bridges that they were able to work on. On the average, 5 or 6 bridges done in kind annually, which is a fifth of the cost than if we would go out for contracting. You know, generally it's about $120,000 to get the parts and to put in a bridge. Vendors cost more like $4 or $5 million. So, you know, that's another reason too. And you know, if we keep pulling from bridges, maybe we need to put more people into the road crew. But we won't know that until we can actually follow where these folks are getting put. And that again, there's your accounting. And that's the only thing it's going to change. It just gives you, you know, a map to follow.
Deputy Gravel.
Just to reiterate that the county executive is very strongly in favor of, you know, looks like reinforcing the bridge crew, and there are 3 of the positions that were additions to public works are bridge crew additions that are in the proposed 24
budget.
What
was the title change?
One
is a new welder and one is a new bridge 2. But then they also took away a bridge person and put them into roads.
But the important part of that is that 16 bridge crew employees, of which they believe they'll be able to operate 2 full crews, which they have not quite been able to. It's been pulled back a bit, right? So they need to be able to operate 2 full crews in the summer so that they can really do all of that work.
Right.
So I think that we wanted to, you know, see staffing the crews fully, and then again look at the substation crews, you know, whether or not there's additional need there. But our first focus was really putting more staff back into the bridge crew.
Mm-hmm. You know, hoping they don't get pulled. And there's also the rail crew, which is a whole separate group. You know, we yeah. frequently, every accident that we have, rails are damaged. You know, don't forget the welders aren't really part of a bridge crew, even though they do some work within the shop, but they also, you know, weld and repair bodies on the dump trucks and, you know, constantly hitting deer, and so they do a lot of those body repairs as well.
I believe there's a separate welder in Central Auto versus the welder that's going to be transferred over to Bridge Crew.
They do it at Van Dale. They do it at Van Dale.
What's their money?
Well, it just strikes me that the job description, like welder or whatever, is what is critical here. And I'm just, this whole conversation making me wonder whether we need to have a separate bridge or road division. If somebody is a welder, I certainly want them to be available to the county to weld wherever it is that we need welding, that they have the training. So I'm not sure that this whole tension between bridge crew and road crew makes sense now that, you know, we have so much going of personnel across, and it does seem to me that they should be being paid for the position that they were hired for. So I appreciate you bringing it to us. I would just say that
generally you don't weld on a road job. That's flat topping. You know, they may put in the nails, but that's not a welding job. So to pull a welder to flag, you know, when they could be welding guardrails and repairing equipment, makes more sense to me. But, you know, again, this is just so that we can actually follow it. So if we have a welder going over, why, maybe they need another flagger. They need another lower level position put into roads. But we don't know that if the jobs are still getting done by pulling from other departments.
So this clarifies for me what my concern is here. This to me seems to be us micromanaging through the division titles what the on-the-job needs, you know, the needs of the county are.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the benefit that we might see what we're doing more clearly. But it worries me a little bit because it then kind of reinforces the desire for somebody who's hired to do what the county needs to say, no, that's not my job. I'm a bridge person. I don't do roads. So that's a little bit of a concern to me, and maybe we'll get it talked out as we go.
Yeah, and that's not going to happen. And I mean, we actually did it, Legislator Nolan, with one-year resolutions. You know, we have a vendor who's providing a staff person, but we want to make sure that it's done at a higher skill level, so we're, you know, putting in a new position there. So I don't know what the difference would be. I don't feel like we're micromanaging this any more than we would be micromanaging the stabilization center.
Yeah, but my only concern is related to the last thing that you know, and I will agree, I'm concerned where we put any restriction on the moving of employees between things. Okay, I just want to make sure that doesn't happen by doing this, and that needs to be worked out, maybe even with the union, that clarifies that somehow, that is not going to happen. But, and we've said it here many times, if you can't see it, you can't measure it. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And that's why I like this, because it helps to see. It's not so much micromanaging. It's managing the budget. You know, we have to see if we're spending more, we're actually spending more in the highway because we're just taking from employees from bridges. Well, then maybe we stop being a little cheap sometimes, and when they ask us for, you know, 10 new employees, we can actually justify it and say, here's the reason why. We've been borrowing skilled labor from another department just to plug in flaggers on a road job. It's not the most effective use of resources. And that will become very transparent when you actually see the numbers. Right now, we just see one giant number. And I like it for that reason. I just am concerned about that.
And what did you say? I want to use that quote.
If you can't see it, you can't measure it. Can't measure it. Can't measure it.
Write that down. Thank you.
Thank you. Just wanted to say that because this is something that the county executive is very interested in, and is devoting resources to, again, reinvigorating the bridge crew, would be happy to report out separately on their progress of public works through the year. Also, just considering that, you know, these were, when the request came in, we very much sit down with the departments and talk about, okay, you know, where is the need? You know, how are your crews functioning? How are the substation crews functioning? How is the bridge crew functioning? Is it possible to increase the budget for summer labor, summer youth workers, so that we have the flaggers for the jobs that are going out, and that's a more cost-effective way to do that work. And it gets folks, sometimes people want jobs outside in the summer, you know, and that's a good fit for some individuals. So we're looking at all of those as we're looking at how do we effectively add staff where we need to, and then reevaluate, you know, is there an impact? Do we need them at the substations? Are they effectively running crews, full crews out of the substations? What did the bridge crew get done, you know, last year, which was three
three big bridge projects, two not as big ones, and also an unanticipated must have been the road stabilization project versus what can they get done with two
Areas.
We've gone after a lot of culvert grants, aquatic passage grants recently that will also rely on in-house bridge crew work to do those. So I'm happy to keep the committee up to date on kind of that progress.
Thank you.
I was going to say that the manage and measure, because I feel the same way. It's just a way, and I think there's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts over public works, and I hear complaints from some of the guys about purchasing, and they'll get one line of weed whacker, and there's times the guy's got to go over and use a county credit card at Herzog, even though he's not supposed to, but otherwise they don't have any weed whacker line. So, and we're supposed to be tracking that purchasing to appropriate the amount, to appropriately come up with the amount we're supposed to purchase. You know, they say they need weed whacker line, they go in, they got two spools. You know, we might want to buy a pallet of that. But it's the same thing here. We need to track, you know, these man hours and where they're being used. And I mentioned it yesterday that I was getting calls from the owner of a winery for over a year, and I think it took almost 3 years to finish this bridge, and she couldn't get any answers, but...
That was contracted, though. I don't believe that was in-house.
There was just one top layer of something that needed to be done. I thought it was the county that wasn't finishing it up. We had a firm that took 3 years.
Was that McKinsey? Yeah, was that contracted or was that in-house?
I think it was contracted, and I believe what one of the problems was that you may know that you had just saw something on the capital that amended this year's capital with updated costs for a bridge project. That was to avoid repeating what happened there, where it was later in the season, and it takes a long time.
Right, and they couldn't pour concrete.
They had to go through winter shutdown, and that was part of the delay. So
well, we went through two winters.
Part of it, I mean, decking was hard. I'm not making excuses, but I mean, that's why the bridge has taken so long at Word Street. The decking was impossible to get. That took them back a year.
Yeah, but the point is, if it's not affecting day-to-day operations, then it's just allowing us to track where the bridge crew is being used. I don't see this being anything but a good thing. And I think back in 07, when we combined all these things into public works, things like this were actual oversights that need to be cleaned up, just like in the schedules with these contracts.
48. This is, again, for bridges. It's adding an additional bridge worker position. Right now we have two MEOs that have been working out of title. One of them had saved up all of his pay stubs and highlighted. It was a significant amount of out of title pay. He offered to let me bring them in. I was a little uncomfortable because it had his personal information on there, but I am able to access those. So that is the reason they were looking for between 3 and 5. The executive did create another position, but I would like to add an additional bridge worker to their workforce.
Debbie, can you move out?
Thank you. again, when looking at requests and headcount requests across the county, we sat down with DPW and discussed what we felt could be accomplished with staffing, and we were comfortable at the suggestions that were included in the budget as far as bridge crew staffing in order to bring us to a place where we have two full bridge crews, and at which time we would feel comfortable evaluating that.
Yeah. I'll about to say, this is micromanaging in my eyes. Mm-hmm. This is us inserting ourselves into the operations. If there is a need after this new position is fulfilled, and they still need it, I don't know why the team would not come back to us and ask for a budget mod later in the year. But to put in something after we're already putting another person, which is already budgeted for,
But there are two people working out of title now, so. I mean, we'll pay for it regardless. I don't know if we should then increase the out of title budget or if we can pull from another line for that. But there are two people working out of title and as a bridge worker, too, and getting paid for it.
Would that theoretically show up if the last thing is passed, the previous thing? So how about a compromise? It would be nice if the executive just supported and nobody fought the separation so we can start to track where these people are. They gave us one staff to the bridge crew. They now say they have two full crews. Now we're going to be able to track how many people are working from the highway or vice versa, how many people are being pulled the highway. So it would just be nice if we passed the last one and maybe let this one go.
Yeah, I do agree. Yeah. But I mean, this particular one is just for bridges.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they can continue doing what they're doing. It'll just be out of title pay, and it'll come out of that budget line.
Well, but I guess that's my point and the stakeholder's point is we'll be able to see that because we'll actually be able to see which ones they're where.
Yeah.
And then if there is a shortage, we'll see somebody constantly showing up on the report. Pretty easy for us to see. I mean, I know you have haste tubs, but that doesn't include the new person, and it doesn't show us the entire thing where people are being moved around.
Fair enough.
You have 49.
Okay. Okay, so I guess this is me micromanaging additionally. This is his proposed amendment number 49. Which is to add in the three emergency communication positions for our E911 center. This was put in with the draft budget request, and it's my understanding a similar issue that we have with our corrections officers is happening with E911, and that's that they get mandated for overtime.
I think this is... While they're looking, I think this is actually a result of not having enough staff because of vacancy, not having enough positions. Sorry, I think Everett said it last night, and I think this is the discussion let's say Ronk and I were having. I don't think this is a shortage of positions, it's a shortage of filled positions. And then there's some claim that it's because of salary, which it very well may be. But I think if we were at full staff, I don't think it didn't sound like that would be an issue.
Can we get clarity on that?
Yeah.
Is that the case?
We'll pull the, I think Victoria has the request to fill data that we were looking at, right? Can you send it to me? I don't have it in front of me. But I think the other issue that we have too is until the Government Operations Center is completed, we literally don't have places for these individuals to sit.
That's a good point. If you haven't been to the 911 center, you should go.
Well, that's going to go on for years.
Yeah, and does this, you know, address the shift changes? Because there's three shifts. So all three shifts are maxed out as far as seats go?
I can only speak, I've only been there during the day, and that place, I can tell you, it's packed. They're on top of each other.
Yeah.
Evening shift, too.
What we're looking at is addressing the mandated overtime by creating enough new positions, so one person can leave, the other person can take their seat. So I don't think the seating would limit them. Or the same person could keep getting mandated to stay in the same seat. But it also creates a possibility of errors being made if they're overtired.
I know over at the jail, a lot of the mandated overtime has to do
with those guys are exhausted.
Unfilled positions as well.
Yeah.
But so it could be unfilled positions. We just don't know how many unfilled positions are there.
15, well, so request to fill data that we have, there were 15 requests to fill during 2023. 60% of those were due to resignations, so 9. And that's just for dispatchers.
So it's a personnel shortage, not a position shortage. Yeah.
Okay, that's all I got.
Were there exit interviews done with all these resignations? Was it...
That I'm not aware of.
Yeah.
Do we know? Was it?
The union says it's salary.
Yeah.
I didn't put in for the salary increases. They're making about $58,000 to start.
Yeah, anecdotally, I could just say that we are competitive. Again, I know somebody who applied but didn't get it, which was odd to hear that we have vacancies, but this person who made the list, former state police dispatcher, EMT, and
sounds perfect.
Yeah, that's why I was surprised last night to hear that. So I just think, you know, I Everett and I talked briefly afterwards. He was going to look into it, but if we're below market, and that's true of all positions, and I think that's where the salary study. I wish there was a way to make it faster than May. But if we are below market, we need to do something about it. I think just across the board, there should be market adjustments, especially in departments that were short of 9 people, you know, a critical department like that. Okay. That's all you have, Liz? Yeah? That's all you have.
That's all I got.
Okay.
Let's say Roberts.
I am asking for a budget amendment of $338,928 to revitalize the Maple Avenue sidewalk replacement project in the capital improvement program. Maple Avenue is a county road in the Clintondale section of Plattekill. Ulster County has recently prioritized its outdoor spaces through trails and park initiatives, as well as other environmental initiatives. Sidewalks play a vital role in both of these initiatives by establishing a safe alternative transportation method. This would also help revitalize the downtown Clintondale business district. It's 960 feet of sidewalk between Route 4455 and Crescent Avenue. As you can see, I sent giving you some pictures to look at. Maple Avenue is a small county road, or not that wide. A lot of it seems to be damaged through snow plowing and salt. I think it's, I provided an estimate too for $338,000. And of that, I can give you a breakdown. $20,000 is for maintenance and protection of traffic, which I think is high because it's only a 960-foot road. It can easily be detoured. $225,000 would be for the replacement in south.
Replacement of what?
Replacement of the sidewalk itself. $36,000 is for 15% overage for a total of $282,000. And $56,000 would be for administrative costs, engineering fees. So engineering's already in that. I think we can get this down even lower if we do it in-house. And Amber was kind enough to look up, and we can get federal grants for this, which would pay 80% of it, leaving the county share as is to $67,786.
Less than money.
Yeah, I've been talking about sidewalks. I myself grew up in a trailer park in Connolly, and my whole life was spent on sidewalks, not walking trails. So I've been watching the tens of millions of dollars being spent over the years. To me, sidewalks are middle and lower middle class trails. My only question is, this is traditionally a county level. If it's a county road, then the sidewalk is considered part of that road. Is there precedent for this?
No, there isn't. The county has in the past shunned a responsibility, I feel, for taking care of this. I think it is a responsibility. A lot of that damage happened, you know, as you can see, through snow plowing, and the curbing just doesn't fall apart like that. So I think some of the damage has been done by the county. And I believe years ago they used to actually run the plow over top of the sidewalk to clean it off.
Do you think this is something that you could use ARPA funds for?
I have talked to Chairman Griswell about that. He was going to look into it. He seemed to be very excited about it, and I think we just plain old ran out of money.
There's none left, you know that. Amber, isn't there some money left?
Right now, the best estimate that I have is $135,000, and I expect that to shake out to be a little bit more, but I plan on further analyzing that over the next 2 weeks before the Ways and Means vote.
And I think the county share would be about $68,000 or less, you know, right now, if we do get federal. So maybe
that's what you're asking for, less than 70 here?
Yes.
When will you know for sure if you're getting the federal aid?
That is something, once this is put into the capital project, that the county executive staff would have to do the research on.
How long would something like that take, a yes or no? Because if we didn't use ARPA funds, it'd have to be a fairly quick answer if we went that direction.
Just a few points of clarification. It's a county road with a town-maintained sidewalk, and it is actually an odd part of New York State highway law, is what I'm being told, is why the town owns and maintains the sidewalk and then the county has the road. So it's not it's not our precedent for that. It's just that arrangement. Projects have to go on to the TIP. We don't have the ability to directly access the federal funds, the 80-20 federal funds, so it would have to go on to the Transportation Improvement Program, which is administered through the Planning Department at UCTC. And then after it's on the TIP, then when DOT gives us approval, then it becomes, we put in the capital project. So there's usually concurrent process around that. So we wanted to look into that before it went on the capital, because as bureaucratic as we are, the New York State DOT is not exactly like Speedy or Limber. So we would need to make sure that it was in process to access DOT funds as well.
So you're telling me that we should wait on putting this in the capital, and you're going to do some research on it?
It's definitely something we need to talk about with the Transportation Council, because they are the experts in accessing federal transportation money, and through which happens through the state DOT and the UCTC. So I think it's, in my opinion, maybe a little early to put it on the capital before we kind of have the process started to have it on the TIP.
The same one.
Would this be possible if, and I guess this is a question more for Amber, if we use lost revenue in ARPA, we take a program of $70,000, we put it into fund balance, earmark it, or into another account, and then we start the process. So we're off the clock with that money. We earmarked it. If it falls through, it's just sitting there in fund balance. We can do whatever we want with it. But then we can take our time and start the process of, and then it's a little more like, we don't usually, but with ARPA we were doing, I don't know if your town got any of the park money, but this is almost a form of that. I think it's appropriate to do something like this through ARPA. It's similar to other things we were doing. I actually wanted to put in a sidewalk ARPA initiative, but never did. And we would get off the clock if we did a lost revenue, and then we take the 70, we put it into fund balance earmarked for this as we wait to see if we get this federal grant. Is that all budgetarily appropriate? What I'm saying, financially appropriate, what I'm saying, Amber?
Utilizing the revenue loss does remove the timeline, but without the using ARPA directly without the revenue loss allows for a little bit more flexibility with the funding going to skip some of the other processes that the county has to undertake. So pro and con, both.
But if it fell through, we wouldn't lose the money. If we got to 24, federal funds don't come in, we don't lose the money. right? So what are the cons? Because what more specifically?
Like having to do like easements and things like that would be the con.
Once it's not technically ARPA funds, there's more red tape.
Yes.
But we could get through the red tape with no risk of losing the money, and it's an appropriate way to spend the money, more so than doing sidewalks regularly, since it is a town-owned piece of property, technically.
Is there no one?
Yeah, I've been told, and not sure that it directly applies, but I think it does, that the ARP funds have to be obligated with a clear obligation by the end of 2024. And so I don't think that ARPA would allow a pot of money to be sitting there undesignated and still be ARPA. And my understanding is ARPA has to be committed to an ARPA project. So I'm not sure this can move along quickly enough for that. We maybe check with the ARPA staff if I'm understanding what I was told in a slightly different context and applying it correctly here. But this is a great project that needs to be done. And I think the Transportation Council would really like it. I'd be happy to work on it. I agree that trails and sidewalks are equivalent types of conveyances for pedestrians and not supposed to be for cyclists, but sometimes are. And they differ in whether or not you're in an urban setting or in a more rural setting in terms of what's the surface and that. But sidewalks are a big problem because of the history of how they've been allocated to businesses and others to maintain. This one, it seems like with cooperation between the town and the county, that the applications could go in, that there are federal fundings, and then it would make sense to me for Ulster County to come in with the match, and then it'd be a different budget figure, that it'd be that $67,000. How it works when we're going to use our own staff to do it and whether this would be an appropriate project for them, I think would be another part of the conversation.
You know, I don't want to bring this up, but the town does have ARPA money left over and they might be willing to use it, but they will need some help with the federal assistance.
So maybe we could have the discussion and that Brian Slack, the transportation planner, and you get together to get the ARPA money to do any part of this that it can do and get it obligated to that. And then that moves the project along so that when it goes in for the federal money, it's a really ready-to-go project which gets funded more quickly.
Cool.
Yeah. The only last comment just quickly is that I'd be happy to help with to set up a meeting, a Zoom, whatever, to discuss the funding different mechanisms and different programs, and the planning department has been really successful over the years of getting a lot of different sidewalk funding. So
I appreciate any help you can
get.
Thank you.
Disruption. My comment on this is this is almost literally the definition of Pandora's box. So while this one project you're presenting us, you know, exists, I can tell you, and I'm sure others who have, sidewalks in their district, the same thing could be said in Napanoc. There's a county road. It was done as a town sidewalk project that they got a grant for, but they ran out of money, so they didn't do the entire length of it, and that's the county road also. So if we're doing this, I don't know how we give one area direct ARPA funds without going out to some competitive application, and then if we do it, if we're going to say this is going to be part of the county procedure going forward, then how many townships does this apply to, and how many miles or feet of sidewalks? Because I can tell you, one in Napanoc is probably 400 yards still worth of sidewalk to do there.
And I wouldn't have a problem seeing these sidewalks rebuilt throughout the county. You know, it might be a better use of our money than some of the other ventures we're looking into right now. Thank you.
I agree with you that it's potential Pandora's box. What has happened in the past is those who come and advocate get the funding, get the attention. And this was a discussion of the town's ARPA funds, which I think would be the better way to go, as was said.
Okay. That was number 8.
Yeah, just Joanna's going to be able to make it. I don't know. You saw my text.
I'm not sure. I know she got called away.
Okay. Okay, well then I'll go with mine. So number 50, so these are various lines that have been over budgeted. Looking at some of them year to date, we've not spent anywhere near the required amount to meet the budget, and I did have conversations with the budget, and they don't necessarily disagree.
Yeah, I think in looking through and working with you, Chair, on a number of these, I think there's a few that we want to continue some of the conversations, but generally speaking, we see where you're coming from and understand what you're looking to do here.
Number 9. This is a placeholder. This is something I need to speak further with Deputy Director Contreras on. So I'm not going to too much on that. Number 51. This. What did I do with that paper you gave me ever? This is because Legislator Criswell is not here. Serves as a placeholder for a technical amendment. This amendment would ensure that all ARPA revenues and expenditures are properly accounted for and that the budget does not contain any duplicative funding. Okay. Legislator Maloney.
So this is just a just keeping the rank and file in mind. It seems a lot of the people that are doing the work in this county, keeping the lights on, keeping the roads plowed, keeping us safe, responding to the domestics at 3 o'clock in the morning, working 3 or 4 mandated overtime shifts at the jail. No matter who the rank and file is, I think we all know they're underpaid. We're well over a quarter century, can you turn that up a little? Thanks. Well over a quarter century between our last salary study, and even though we passed a law almost 2 years ago that we would immediately do one, we dragged our feet through several years and now through another budget cycle. And as they pull in here, and we have pregnant women and elderly people walking blocks and feeding meters to go into the DMV. We still haven't addressed the parking lot issues and have 8 or 9 parking spots for the county elites that often aren't even used. Healthcare premiums for management is still at 10%, while all our unions hired over the past 20 years have gone 15% and 20%. Take-home vehicles galore, as the men and women over DBW are driving rust buckets during the day in their own vehicles there. They're watching Mustangs pull in. And to me, as we wait for this salary study and we all acknowledge how underpaid our rank and file union members are, I think it's appropriate to hold off on all raises for anybody, just the upper echelon. Let us be really, truly appreciative of what we have. Let us really be appreciative of what we have and acknowledge the men and women doing the real hard work in this county and what they don't have, salaries anywhere near the upper echelon, take-home vehicles, and a lot of other fringe benefits. So this is just taking anybody that is already making over $100,000 and putting their raises into contingency while we await that salary study. I think it sends a message and something we forget. We don't forget about it in the private sector. We don't forget about it on sports teams and other things, but culture. And the culture, when you talk to the rank and file, the culture of this county is so bad. It's gotten so bad. And we legislators and elected officials gave ourselves a raise.
just last year. I think it even went retro back at the beginning of the year. And still we wait for the salary study so we can supposedly give the rank and file what they deserve. We'll see when that actually happens. But I think this is just a real nice message to send to the over 1,000 people that work in this county and keep our lights on. And that's that. If you're making over $100,000 a year already, or just taking it, putting it into contingency, maybe we can even get a little bit of interest on our money, perhaps, if it sits there. And when the salary study comes in, we can then pay those people as well. That's my thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Legislator Maloney, do you know when that salary study's coming out? I heard May.
Supposedly. Wouldn't it be nice if I heard, Chair John, you said you wish there was a way to speed it up. This might just be a way to speed it up. Because the people that are responsible for getting it are many of the ones that will be waiting for their raise as well at the same time.
The study is going to be all-inclusive, management.
I was in the impression it's everybody, and we were supposed to be checking both pubs surrounding counties and local private sector against all positions that we can.
Now, these raises that you're not given to the upper echelon, if this salary study shows something different, would you be willing to give that raise back retro?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to clarify, we are giving increases essentially to everybody, both union and non-union, throughout the county. What I think the salary study, and I think what sort of the direction that I've been pushing for, is that market adjustment is where I think the salary study comes into play. And I would support even the ones that got more than the 2.5 or whatever the percentage of, across the board has been, not go down into contingency lines for now until the salary study comes out. But to not give the same increase across the board, I don't know that. I don't know.
I think the thought behind it is there's that $100,000 mark is kind of a mark that's in all our consciousnesses. Like that's most people feel that's the level at which you're really making money. And so the people that are really making money, and I mentioned the culture and the message that it sends, and it does. It tells our rank and file that we're taking it seriously now. We're taking the salary study seriously. We hear you. We know you're hurting. We know that over the last couple of years, I think this is one of the first years, correct me if I'm wrong, that, which is nice, even though our health insurance, I'm hearing, isn't as well looked at with a lot of providers around here these days. We may have to address that at some point. But premiums, I don't think, are going up the way they have. And the raise in premiums over the last couple of years up until this year has been bigger than the increments that these unions are getting. So what I'm hearing from these people is, the couple of percentage points I got last year, my premiums went up higher than that. So, I mean, our rank and file are suffering. We hear people working two full-time jobs, that's heartbreaking. And meanwhile, it was us. We did owe the rank and file the salary study long before we're doing it now. And we did drag our feet all last year. It was supposed to be done last year, and now it's not. And now we tell them to wait again. And I just think for morale, for culture, for doing what's right, and to kind of take a bite out of elitism, which has kind of wiggled its way into government on every level, including ours, I think it's a nice message and an appropriate message. And I know there's people making $100,000 a year in this county that would have no problem with it, you know. And the ones that do, well, that's the rank and file feels.
Is there no?
Yeah, I guess that I think that there are some positions where this would not create a problem, but some of the raises that we have talked about for some of these higher paid positions do make us competitive in ways that are important to be competitive in terms of filling and keeping those positions filled. So I don't tend to like these across-the-board approaches. I prefer to look at specific instances, and maybe there is something that could be done along those lines that I think would be better, because we spent a lot of time and we've had discussions to try to come to appropriate salary figures in the absence of the salary study. And I think there may be reasons beyond motivation of why the salary study is not back yet. We have been through a pandemic. So I prefer to look at individual cases, and you know, if there are individual cases where we're contemplating a raise and we have not made funding available to people that should have raises, then I putting it aside into contingency seems like a good plan, but I'm not so keen on just doing it across the board.
I didn't think it was across the board. I thought that was like the John kind of thought it wasn't across the board, right? That if all of management would have been across the board. This is just, and then it would have been, well, there are people, there is management that's making, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. So this is just the upper echelon. It's not across the board whatsoever. It's a handful of the highest paid people in the county. It's literally the opposite of across the board.
So the algorithm is over $100,000, which is an algorithm that gets applied whatever the position is, which is what I mean by across the board. And I think that we could make other algorithms that might do some of what you're talking about. You could say anybody whose salary is raised more than 15%, we would handle in this way. So yeah, I take it that it's not all positions. And I appreciate that. You're trying to have this address people who have a high salary already. And I'm sympathetic to that. But I just think that by doing it with an algorithm without doing an individualized case-by-case analysis, we can end up hurting things that we have worked hard to try to fix and protect. I'm thinking about some of the positions in the Department of Health and forensic pathologist. I don't know for sure that that's up again this year, but that's a very highly paid position, and it is extremely competitive, and we are mandated by law to have it. I don't know from this analysis that's provided to me that we would not put ourselves in the position of not being able to be competitive and keep or attain, fill that position. And I think that's one of many that I can imagine. So that's what I mean by so a better way to say it, so it wouldn't undermine your valid attempt to help lower paid individuals and not overly benefit highly paid individuals, is I prefer a case-by-case analysis when we can do it and when we need to do it.
City Rockets.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Legislator Maloney, do you know how many employees are on this list offhand?
I don't have the exact number. Amber or Natalie, do you have
maybe 25, 30?
Yeah.
I can pull it up.
Don't have to be exact. My colleague from Shandaken does have a good point that there may be somebody that we need to keep competitive. I am sure at this point everybody who's on this list has seen it. Department heads have seen it. Maybe by the time we bring this to the floor next month, that they could give us a list and reasoning why they should be taken off of it, competitive edge, whatever. And maybe we could make that case by case. If there's somebody on there that we have to give the raise to for whatever reason, we could exempt them.
34.
I just want to just state that these are cost of living increases, and just in line with some of the other comments, that there are certain positions that, if I think about, we've recently filled
that are very important to the county, and I'd just be concerned about perhaps the unintended consequences of being able to recruit. And in particular, when I look at this list, I think about the head of economic development and also the commissioner of finance, which we want to be able to recruit the most capable, highest skilled people we can to those positions.
In response to that, I would say, don't let the door hit you. If you just took a job making over $100,000 a year with the county, and you can't wait till we get a salary study so we can better understand how lowly our rank and file is being paid, then I mean that. Bye. But that's me, and I have a hard time believing that over a couple of thousand dollars, and the idea that they would probably end up getting it immediately when that salary study comes in. I'd like to think that they'd say, I get it. I appreciate that. That's fine. I'm okay with it. Happy to be here. That's what I hope they'd say.
Mr. Roberts. Yeah, to me, it's hard to justify a cost of living increase when you're making $106,942. You know, and you're going to get an extra $2,742. You know, it's the old saying, the more you make, the more you spend. But, you know, most people can live on $106,000
a year.
Yeah, I guess the other assumption that seems to be coming into play here is that this is a zero-sum game, that if these positions are handled this way, that it makes it more difficult, or somehow that's a been a motivation in not handling others' salary conversations differently. And I don't have the sense of that. We have been in a setting of having good resources. And so I think the attempt has been made to fill positions. And I'm noticing, for example, that looks like four of the positions that would be slated for being put in this category are emergency communications, that we just talked about as an earlier budget amendment, that we are feeling that we have nine positions unfilled or more than that because we're not competitive. So the analysis for each of these positions is something that I think has been done in the executive branch in bringing this to us. And if there are specifics where we feel like we know better because we think that we can get equally qualified people for a lower rate, then that would be smart to do. But that, again, is a case-by-case analysis. And I'm just not prepared to support removing increases in salary for positions that we're trying to fill. We've got positions at probation. These are people that are rank and file people in some of these cases. And sheriff's office and jail, I don't want to decrease the salary of anybody who's working at our jail. The better paid staff we have, the more likely we are to have good services in I think all of these positions. Public health administrators, I just, as I go through this list, I find it really hard, without looking at their salary, to say we should be removing them from the realm of a cost of living increase. I think somebody could make the case by case, but this is basically saying, if you make a lot of money, we want to hold you up on that. And it's not even a lot of money. In some of these positions, $106,000 is not the median salary for that profession. And that's a bigger issue. We need all of our legislators to come and talk about that situation. And I'd be happy to have that conversation. I've never thought that people who work behind a desk should get more than people who dig ditches. Never made sense to me from the time I was a kid. You work harder, you work hard, you should get paid more. And a lot of people who work behind a desk, including myself, don't work that hard. So I'd have that conversation. But that's not the world we currently live in. And if we want to have good people in our jail and in our probation department, and we want to have people sitting at those emergency call desks, then I think we should be careful about just saying
you don't deserve this. I think all of our workers deserve the most we can give them, consistent with taking care of all the other obligations that the county has.
You know, this is, I think, kind of a microcosm of what's going on all over the country, especially in government. And here we are with this beautiful view on the sixth floor, talking ourselves out of just a momentary pause in everyone making over $100,000 when we know how underpaid our rank and file are and how much they're suffering. You know, and on top of it, every one of these people here is only paying 10% or less for their health insurance, while everybody that's been hired over at DPW for the last 10 years is paying twice as much for their health insurance as they make a third or half of what they're making over $100,000. But that's what I'm talking about with elitism, you know, sneaking its way into government and taking over, and how out of touch we have become. And if we had an auditorium full of our actual constituents watching these kinds of conversations sometimes when we decide not to raise health care premiums on management to match the union, when we decide to drag our feet even longer on the salary study, when we decide not to just momentarily pause the very highest paid people in the county for a minute while we get the long overdue salary study, we talk our way out of it. We just go through and we read their title and go, oh my God, how could I ever? Well, I could. We'll see if 11 others could too, because I think it really would be, after socking our union left and right, just one jab after another, one hit after another, year after year after year, it'd be nice to send this message to them. And maybe it would motivate us a little bit, because a lot of the people that haven't gotten the job done with the salary study for years are the highest paid people in this county. But they got parking spots, and they got cheap insurance, and they got big paychecks. So why hurry?
The only thing I'll say about ceremony is that I would actually support sort of an opposite approach to this, is that, and I know the salary study, while I don't think May, I think that is far out, I hope it can be shortened up, I know that it does take time to do them, because you're especially going after private sector salaries and public and neighboring counties, towns, it's going to require a lot of data collection. I would actually support us retroing that pay to the first of the year, despite when we get it done, for the rank, for any position, I don't want to say rank and file, any position that we determine is below market rate and we need to increase, I actually would argue that we should do that retro to the beginning of the year, despite when the salary study gets completed. I don't necessarily support across the board, even at any level. I think that just, you know, that has, one has nothing to do with the other. And I don't know that it would push anybody, you know, to your point, even you said, you know, 2.5% it's not a whole lot of money. In a sense, you're right, and I don't know how much motivation it would be to or what it could do to even incentivize this to get done quicker. But I would support it absolutely, retroing it back to the first, because
you're saying that when the salary study comes back and basically has a recommendation for every single position in the county, that you would immediately move to line everybody up with that and give them retro?
If we agree on the position and the amount, yeah.
What does that mean, we agree on?
Well, because you're going to get a range, and with the salary study, you're going to get a range within there. And if we agree on an amount, then yeah, annualize that amount, and that's what they should make annually. And I would push it. I mean, it's coming out of contingency anyway. No matter what we do, all this money is coming out of contingency, and we keep it. And let's say, you pointed out yesterday, we've got a hefty fund balance in excess of our policy. This could easily
you could be talking $20-30 million for the entire county.
No, I don't think we're that far off. I would be very surprised if we. What's that?
Over a couple of years, you're talking tens of millions of dollars.
What do you mean over a couple?
When we get this salary study, if we moved everyone up where they belong, it's going to be huge numbers. I don't think we're going to, I think we're going to have the salary study, but I don't think we're going to end up being able to afford to do what the salary study suggests, to be honest with you, outright.
I don't believe we're, I think you and I have different opinions. I don't think we're as far off as you think we are in terms of market rate for our positions. I think
the Chair Bartels just said to me the other day, somehow I'll read this number like that. A couple months ago, she mentioned it, like how scary it was, the salary study and what it's going to show. But so me and Chair Bartels agree on that, but we'll see. Look, I don't, you know, I don't expect this to pass. I don't think it's a big deal. I think it should. I think it would send a wonderful message, but I don't expect us to do something so easy, reasonable, and what a nice message it would be. But to be honest, I don't think it would hurt our motivating, you know, being a motivating factor to get the salary study done. But because if it's such a big deal and people are actually going to walk away if they don't get it, how are they not going to be motivated to go? And then you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh my God, somebody may walk away over this 2,000, but then on the other hand go, well, they're not going to work harder to get the salary study done.
They weren't said that.
What's that?
That those two statements were said by two different people.
Yeah, I know, but there are only a couple people in the room when those statements were made. I'm saying they're...
Well, we disagree with each other, that's all. I don't agree that they're going to walk away, and the other person doesn't agree that it's a motivator. Listening on.
Yeah, again, I would just say that I don't accept the premise that our staff and these people are not maximally motivated to cooperate to get the salary study done. It's not entirely in our hands, and this doesn't do anything to motivate the consultants. And also the idea that we pit higher level salary positions against other salary positions, I think is not healthy for the workplace. I think we should all be pulling to try to get everybody what they need and what's appropriate. And I also have said and will say again, I favor pushing the edge. The salary study, you know, I would agree with Chair Gowaras. If we wouldn't crash the budget to do it, I would make those increases in salary retroactive to the beginning of the year. And I would try to have our lower paid positions go to the upper ends of the comparable brackets and not make that same push for some of the higher management, higher salary positions. Because I think if we bring up the salaries of those who are making less, we're going to have a healthier workplace and a healthier community. There is research data actually to show that.
And I just want to restate that the salary study will be finished in May, and will be that timing will allow us to both to inform the contract negotiation and the budget process.
Perfect. Unfortunately, let's say he left, but going back to number 45.
On budget amendment 45, which is the changes in the DSS position, I was looking to you for the details, and so if you're prepared, that would be great.
So, sorry, I don't have my notes in front of me, but basically DSS requested a number of positions in their budget. We approved two that were fully funded by the state and two others based on the justification that they gave. But ever since then, we've been talking to them and recognizing that the number of people who are in emergency housing has gone up, unfortunately, significantly since they first submitted their request. It does make sense to us, based on the caseload, that they need additional people to process the paperwork and determine eligibility for those programs. It is a distinct job from the department that, from the unit that we created, which is meant to be a much more flexible, kind of broad-based resource for people who are either in emergency housing or need emergency housing. So that's why we are approving their request for a principal suite and a regular suite, and those are both within the temporary housing unit. Apart from that, we are also swapping for two positions that they believe are the most critical. That's one in CPS and one in foster care. Instead of two other ones that we had approved, which one of which was a junior accountant, which they will, they'll make sure that those functions are performed through altering people's work schedules, because that is an important function, but in terms of critical services to people in need of social services, that's not one that they would prioritize because they can get it done in other ways.
How does this relate to yesterday's discussion about the housing workers? I'm going to forget the name mm-hmm. you just said.
This is, well, I'm repeating a lot of what I said yesterday. So do you mean like how does it relate to the other unit?
I guess this is just sort of just sounds like the same conversation which you were not here for, unfortunately. We're trying to anticipate what we need before we even add the new positions in.
Mm-hmm.
So do we really need to go to this level mm-hmm. if we're adding the? So can you say the name one last time of the new positions? The
housing and homelessness unit.
There you go. Thank you. I'll try to remember the name.
Okay.
Housing and homelessness unit. With the staff that you've proposed for that unit, is there really a need for this as well? And how do we know that?
Yeah, well, because their need for these positions is substantiated by the caseload increase that they're experiencing. The other positions that we added are in response to a separate issue we're facing, which is that we get a lot of calls, I think a lot of people in this room get calls from folks who are in emergency housing and need help in a much more general way. The SWEs don't really, they're not social workers in the sense that they don't like sit down and help people fill out their applications. They don't go on site and like walk people through the process, help them apply for permanent housing. They're eligibility determiners. So the positions that we're adding are really meant to be like caseworkers who are much more in depth and like intensive and working with people who are high need, who like, and those folks like call, they call legislators a lot, they call our office a lot, they tend to be really like in frequent contact.
Yeah, I think of the housing and homelessness unit as extending on what has just been explained as being sort of like healthcare navigators that somebody might encounter if they get into a healthcare system these days, that just the system is complicated enough that it helps them to get through it, and also filling gaps, which we've seen works in the recovery realm very nicely. And to do something in the homelessness realm looks like it may have similar sorts of benefits. Not everybody needs a lawyer who is homeless. So I see that effort as being complementary to this. This is our existing system, right, which is now being overloaded. And so it is true that if some of those people get handled well and they're not into this system, then that would be good. But this system is not going to be fixed by that complementary system with any short time period like years, I don't think. And some of these people are specifically credentialed to be able to submit paperwork that brings down state and federal dollars to fund all of this. I mean, not all of it, because we're putting in monies from other pots as well, but that fund all of our existing programs. So I see it as shoring up our existing programs and getting that ready to handle the caseload, and then make the homelessness and housing as making things better from there. But I think it will be a long time before we would not need this. And the shifting those people, that was part of what made me very happy to carry this amendment, to have those specifically trained people available to fill out the paperwork, because you can fill out the paperwork, but if you don't do it properly, or if you're not even the right credentialed person to sign it, it just doesn't go. It just doesn't work. And so those two people, I think, you know, definitely make sense. And the other changes make sense to me as well.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing now, and I may be imagining this, but what I think I'm hearing is the housing and homeless division sounds like to me, it's ringing in my ears as 311-211. And this amendment here is more about actually doing work and getting people help to help with the caseload. So
that's my perception.
Talk me way out of that.
I wouldn't say that, because 311-211 is literally just making connections. These folks will have a caseload of people that they're working with and working through. Like, well, we would like to see the housing specialist connecting people to permanent housing, and actually helping them fill out applications and helping them like go to the unit and advocating for them through that process. That's something that we've helped people do through our office. I know that's something that Legislator Erner does as well. So just feeling that we need to have that dedicated resource instead of like this person or that person trying to do it here and there when they get approached by somebody who's like very desperate. That's not something that SWEs are really equipped or trained or funded to do. They're funded to do eligibility determination. And then so that's the housing specialist. The housing resource navigator is supposed to be in the field, at going to the different hotels and motels and facilities and actually like having eyes on those places, talking to the people at the motels, so that we have like a timely regular update on the conditions at the facilities. So like that person is supposed to be very mobile. So again, not 211-311, because they're going to be going to the different locations.
So why does this need efforts? Again, I go back to, why do we need the management structure there? Why can't this all be done through DSS and not have to have a management person in there? And I mean, you're right, we do get phone calls, I think we all do.
Yeah.
I've gotten just over the weekend, Friday evening, somebody was forwarded to me because they were put in Ellenville with no access to any food. So worked, you know, through my connections to get them some resources. But I don't see how this all functions together to where we have to have a management position in there. I'd rather see more people doing work than managing. That's just, I guess, my argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're trying to do like a, it's really like a more transformative, like change management effort in terms of improving the experience of people in emergency housing and putting that quality, you know, kind of customer service first. It makes sense to give it its own charge and have a unit like specifically dedicated to that. Having it within the existing structure, I think it dilutes the potential impact of it, because then you'll have it within a structure where people are more used to doing the existing programs, doing eligibility determinations. Everybody is very overloaded. I don't know if it'll get the time and effort and attention that it deserves. And our concern was that by just putting it within the existing structure, it may not have the impact that we really want it to have, which is like somebody dedicated to that function and accountable for specifically improving the experience of people in emergency housing. not just like getting people through the process, getting them qualified and getting them enrolled.
Okay.
Yeah, I've made the apt analogy before too in the recovery realm, but we also have this with mental health, where we have mental health peers. This is not per se a peer program, but it's, I think, designed to feel that way, that this is somebody, that the people that you're encountering in this unit are connecting with you specifically around homelessness and not poverty, not mental illness, not substance use, but just that if you don't have a home, you have a special circumstance that we get and that we are making a priority. So I think I agree with the deputy executive. It's not 311, 211, which I was willing to accept. It is really that creating of a navigator, I think is a good word, and somebody who can be an advocate as well, like with the hotels. Some of the things that happen at the hotels could be fixed very easily if there's a person from the county there who knows what the county's expectations are and so forth, and just bring together the observations and the mechanism for intervening. And often the hotel management is willing to do it as well, but they often are not willing to talk to the clients in the same way. So anyway, this is, I think that this change is what you described. It's in this current structure that we have, and we have to keep doing the things that keep people eligible and keep the funding coming in for them and that keep us aware of the different resources and so forth. But where we've had a gap is that those people that we already have hired in these structures are already maxed out, and the need isn't being met. So this is not only complementary, but extending beyond. It'll make everybody's experience in the system better, but I think it will also get us further into getting those existing temporary shelters to work well for us. And right now, that's not DSS's charge at all. It's nobody's charge. It hasn't been anybody's charge as far as I see it.
One of the things that I would also like to ask the unit to do is to take a look at the different contracts that we have related to emergency housing and assess whether that is having as much, whether we will continue to need all of them with this unit in existence. Because, for example, we have different contracts with Community Action, with REPCO, with Family of Woodstock, that provides services, outreach, connections to people in emergency housing, and part of that is because we haven't had these in-house positions. But having people in DSS who are doing that will allow us to get a better centralized sense of what all those services are and whether or not we will continue to need them. We may continue to need them depending on the demand and whether, you know, I mean, we hear all around like caseloads are just, they're really, really tough. But it may also be that there's an opportunity to decrease those if these three positions can meet a lot of that need or some of that need. So, but that's what I would also be asking them to do.
Okay. Well, I have a slightly better understanding of what you're trying to accomplish with this. But again, I go back to not what this is said today, but something I've said in the past. And this is, I try to equate things to what I know, and healthcare is what I've done for 23 years now. So the problem I see with all of these things is they're all done independently. There is no care, there is no case manager assigned to an individual person that sees into all the things. So what I mean by that is if a person has cancer, they broke their femur, they got COVID, they also need dental services. In that scenario, there's no GP overseeing all those different things. They're all being done independently of each other, and it doesn't solve the, there's no coordination between those different needs. You know, and the same thing in what we're doing. We have housing issues, food insecurities, addiction sometimes, but there's no one person to push that person through all of the processes and manage it to get them out of that. That we're just perpetuating the problem. We're just continuing on forward. We're not doing, in my opinion, we're not doing a good enough job to get them out of that cycle. And that's where this doesn't address that, and I don't see anything that we've done so far that looks like it is going to, but I guess that's where I'm looking for, is to try to sort of not treat the symptoms, but try to cure the disease. And that's,
I think that's a really, really great point. And I think when you think of like the housing first model, the idea is that first somebody needs to have a house, some place to put their head down, and then only then can they start to work on mental health and all these other issues. One benefit to having positions that aren't constrained by federal and state funding sources is that we will tell this group, like, what, you know, the person that's in front of you, what they need help with, you should try to help them as best you can, and they'll have the latitude and the flexibility to do that. I know that's like part of the approach. That's the approach that Legislator Erner takes, and like when we help people in our office, we can try our best to help them with whatever they need. It's much more flexible than just. And that is one thing that people experience now when they go to DFS, is there's a SNAP unit, there's a HEAP unit, there's a temporary housing unit, there's so many different units, and unfortunately, because of the structures, they're not seamless. They're not experienced as seamless by people who go to DFS. The idea behind this unit is that these people are really going to be charged with making sure that that's as seamless as possible.
But there's no coordination still with all those other services. That's, like, that's what I'm saying is, I agree, we need to have the housing first. Okay, that sounds logical, but it's not sustainable long term if you don't address the other issues. That is the reason why they're housing insecure or homeless. They need food while they're in housing. You're putting them in the motels, and I'm preaching to the choir now, and we've talked about this before, but putting in a motel that has no ability to cook or heat up food, has no microwave inside of it, just makes a further problem for them. They're spending money. The ones that I got called on Friday, they spent up all their WIC money by going to the gas station and using their card to buy food because there's a microwave at the gas station, and they were able to buy Hot Pockets or whatever they bought. I don't know. But again, having somebody to help to see what problems is, do they have a job? No. Okay. Can we get them a job? Where are the gaps? And make those different silos. Have somebody walking them through each one of the silos together, and then seeing where does their individual problems, where do they have an issue with, and where they don't, and then try to resolve it step by step. Unfortunately, we haven't done that yet, and I guess I'm just venting frustration with we're stepping along. I appreciate that we're going forward. Mm-hmm. It just.
I hear you. No, I think that's a good point, and I do think that this is a step in that direction, because people in the unit, if you have people dedicated to this in a very flexible way, they can tell us, right? Like, these folks in this place don't have, I mean, again, I keep bringing it back to Legislator Erner, because he brings a lot of these issues to us, and he's not going to be here next session, and it shouldn't be on one, you know, it should be somebody's full-time job to say, these are the shortcomings with the system, these are all the different ways that we need to be helpful. And I think when you're freeing up people's time and giving them their resources to focus on this, they can do that, and they can coordinate with the mental health department. We do have a single point of access in the mental health department. That's one point of access for all of those services, so we'll make sure to connect them with that department as well. But definitely, like, the charge for the department will be to be as broadly helpful as possible, with the goal, like, their main goal is to make sure that people are in housing. But there's, I mean, innumerable issues that go along with that.
Our next meeting is the 29th, yeah, 6 o'clock? 5 o'clock.
Motion to adjourn?
We don't need one, we don't have one, so if it's unofficial, we need to have a form to start, so.
have to have cars.